This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Traditionally, world leaders worried about the politics of power, their main concern being who had it, how they used it, who might be amassing more of it. Now, more and more leaders worry not about the growth of power, but its absence. Failed states, once largely the province of humanitarians, has moved to the very center of global politics. The papers are plastered with stories stemming from unstable countries, reports of the Islamic militia that claimed power in Somalia's capital today, the deepening instability in East Timor, and yet another bloody weekend in Iraq. Failed states breed poverty, disease, refugees, and civil war. They export terrorists, drugs, and refugees. Our main focus this hour is failed states, how they're defined, the dangers they represent to their people, to their neighbors, and to the world, and what can be done about them. Later in the program, we'll check in on Mexico's presidential election. There's a critical debate tomorrow night. And have you ever wanted to be a pirate when you grew up? The strange, sad, and brief story of 11-year-old John King. But first, failing states. What brings a country to the verge of collapse? Do failing states constitute a threat that we need to address? The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. According to an index from Foreign Policy Magazine and the Fund for Peace, 2 billion of the world's people live in nations in danger of collapse. David Bosco, a senior editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, has reported recently from Bosnia and Afghanistan on peacekeeping missions in those countries, and he joins us now in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program today.
Great to be with you.
Sudan is number one on the index. Why?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the severe humanitarian crisis that's going on there in terms of the Darfur region in the west, but also the ongoing conflict between north and south, which has been seems to have been alleviated for the time being, but it's still a very fragile situation. So in essence, it's a government that is hanging by a thread, that is facing significant security problems in the west and the south, and also some complications in the east. And so I think this year's ranking is a reflection of that very severe crisis there.
Mm-hmm. How do you define failed state?
Well, there are a good number of definitions floating around out there. I think the most concise is kind of a government that has lost control of its territory, a government that can't provide basic security, that can't provide services to its population, that can't defend its borders. That doesn't have a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. That's a term that is often used to describe a failed state. The failure can come in many different forms. In some cases, a government might lose control of the economy first, and the economy might just become the black economy or the gray economy. In other cases, you'll have armed uprisings that are a very frontal challenge. So it can be, you know, overt or covert. And I think one of the advantages of the index is that it allows us to assess a number of different factors, economic, political, military, social. And there are some surprising results that emerge from the study.
Mm-hmm. Delegitimization of the state is one of the factors. You assign these numerical values, and I guess fundamentally it comes down to some subjective judgments.
It does. As a first cut, the index actually just kind of goes through and electronically, they use a system that pulls all sorts of reports and media reports, even things like corporate filings, and looks for certain keywords and then puts those together and you get a raw score. And then those are, as you say, looked over by some experts mm-hmm. to import their own judgments to some extent.
And this is the second year you've been doing this, and presumably at Foreign Policy Magazine, presumably this index will gather some credibility over time, but also self-correction.
Yeah, self-correction. And it's important to recognize that the index is really a snapshot, because there's a window of time about 4 or 5 months where the data is gathered. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, you see Pakistan comes out as the 9th most vulnerable state, and the Pakistani government was quite livid when they found that out. But that, I think, in part reflects the fact that there was the horrific earthquake there, which really strained all of the state institutions, put an enormous burden on the state, and made it, I think, more vulnerable in the same way that a severe sickness would make a person more vulnerable. And so, this is a snapshot. But year to year, I think you can get a sense of what's changing in a state. And there have been some very interesting changes. China, for example, seen in the popular media as an economic powerhouse, slipped significantly in the ratings, which I think may reflect kind of hidden tensions in that country, even as the economy booms.
All the protests against seizures of land, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. I think last year there were, by an official estimate, 87,000 protests in the country. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that there is a China that's been left behind, the booming coastal economy. And people are very uncomfortable with the way that developers have come in and snatched up land. And you have a peasant economy that is essentially crumbling as the coastal economy leaps forward. And so this index helps to diagnose that kind of latent tension in a society.
Mm-hmm. What about the states, though, at the top of the list? I mean, these Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Ivory Coast, Iraq, Zimbabwe, are they better or worse?
Well, Sudan has fallen significantly. Last year, Ivory Coast was the most vulnerable state. And so there's some shifting that's gone around in there. But when we look at the very top, with the exception of Pakistan, which jumped up into the top 10, you see a lot of the same countries. And I think that reflects the fact that it's just very hard often to break this cycle of state failure. Because you have, you know, militias that emerge and then they fight with other militias and it becomes very difficult for a central government to maintain control. And so you often have, you know, year after year you have failure that continues and it's just a very difficult cycle for countries to break.
We're talking about failed states, what defines that and what to do about it. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Sam. Sam calling from Portland, Oregon.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Both my wife and I grew up in Africa. My wife in Zimbabwe, me in Congo. And one of the things that we have noticed is that there seems to be a failed equality in terms of how the West will take all the resources but give nothing in return, either in terms of democracy or in terms of equitable distribution of wealth. Or we don't even keep people accountable, the leadership.
Let me ask you, I guess broadly, that's a question about the legacy of colonialism, David Oscar.
And I think there certainly is a view out there that when you look at in particular when you look to Africa, and I think 6 of the top 10 and 11 of the top 20 vulnerable states in the world are from Africa, there is this view that what we're dealing with are countries that have been looted by the West, essentially. I think there's obviously some truth to that, but I think what we focus on as we analyze the results of the index are that it's really leadership more than location that makes a difference. Because you see countries that have been under colonialism that have emerged and done relatively well. You see others that have acquired very bad leadership and are in free fall. Zimbabwe is a good example of that. I don't think anyone would say that what Zimbabwe's current crisis is a direct result of colonialism. I would say it's a direct result of the very poor leadership there by Robert Mugabe. And so I think colonialism and that legacy is definitely part of the equation. I personally find it very difficult to attribute, you know, decades on to attribute all of the success or failure in Africa to colonialism.
Sam?
I'm not so concerned about the colonial aspect. I mean, I understand that. My concern is more that we are wanting the physical resources, the natural resources, and we create conflict in places like eastern Congo because we want those resources.
Well, I guess what I would say is that there are plenty of places in the world where people want resources. People want resources that come from all over the world. And in many cases, I mean, you know, copper or something comes from Chile and plenty of other examples of commodities trade. But that doesn't always lead to conflict. What leads to conflict is poor governance, corruption, that kind of thing. And so I think it's incorrect to say that it's just a result of the hunger for resources because, you know, resource hunger can lead to a booming economy or it can lead to situations like we see in eastern Congo. And so I think it goes significantly beyond the need for resources.
Yeah, okay. I appreciate that.
Thanks for the call, Sam.
All right, thanks.
Let's talk now with John. John calling from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, hi. How are you guys doing?
Okay.
Great.
I was just wondering and curious if the United States was looked in on your study and where it ranked.
Yeah, in fact, that's one change that we've had from last year's index. We actually ranked 148 countries, and so we actually got to include a lot of the most industrialized countries in the world, which was great because it gave us, you know, the opportunity to compare and look at how countries that we normally think of as very stable are doing. And the U.S. came 128 out of 146 countries. So, you know, safely in the stable zone, but not as stable as, for example, countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland. Both the U.S. and France seem to have suffered a bit in this year's index. The U.S. because of Katrina, which is in some ways could be looked at as a pocket of failure. Even in very stable states, you get examples where governance fails. Katrina would be an example of that in the U.S. And then in France, you had the horrific riots in parts of Paris and other parts of the country. And that's what we would call another example of a pocket of failure. So the U.S., you know, comes out ranked high, but not nearly as strong as some other countries.
Thanks, John.
All right, thank you.
We've been all reading about the disruptions and the violence and the terrible situation in East Timor of late. I wonder, was this study in any way predictive of that?
It actually wasn't, unfortunately, because East Timor is not included because of information problems. There are a handful of places where we weren't able to get the information needed to conduct a ranking. But East Timor is a good example of a country where there's been what was seen as a successful international intervention. They had a UN force there led largely by the Australians, and they were able to go in and instill a semblance of order and good government. And then in the last few days, as you mentioned, we've seen things kind of spiral out of control again. And that, unfortunately, is something that we see again and again as you look at these states, these vulnerable states. Some states will reach a certain level where they have new institutions, and then things will go wrong. And so, unfortunately, it just takes trying and trying again. Bosnia is a good example of a country that has been trying, you know, continually over the last decade with outside help to stabilize, and this year improved significantly in this year's index. So there's some reason for hope, but unfortunately there will be this cycle in a lot of countries.
We're talking with David Bosco, senior editor of Foreign Policy magazine, about failed states, how they're defined, the dangers they pose, what they mean to us. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about failed states, how they're defined, the danger they represent to their people, to their neighbors, to the world, and what can be done usefully. Our guest is David Bosco, a senior editor of Foreign Policy magazine. Of course, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255 is the phone number, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And joining us now is Professor Robert Rotberg, who's director of the Program on Intrastate Conflict and Conflict Resolution at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, the author of Why States Fail, Causes and Consequences. He joins us by phone today from Montreal. And, Professor, very good of you to be with us.
Delighted to be with you, Neil.
And why should we care about failing states other than, of course, the plight of the people there?
Well, we should care about failing states because they're the center of conflict in the world and the center of putting people down in the world, more conflict, the 15 million lives lost in the last 15 years have been mostly in failed states. So when a state goes down the tubes, its people suffer enormously.
Is there concern that sometimes to describe something as a failed state is another definition of state we don't like?
No, certainly not. Particularly my method is calibrated on even a quantitative measurement, states fail not when we don't like them, but they fail when they stop serving their people with the performance of good governance.
Do failing states present a global security threat?
Of course they do. They represent a growing global security threat. Afghanistan was a failed state. Now it's on its way back, we hope. Lebanon was once a failed state and now is a strong state. There are Sudan, Congo, Liberia, Sierra Leone were all failed states. Sudan and Congo still are. And so we have to worry about those states that are slipping into failure, to particularly Haiti, Nepal, Papua New Guinea is next. The Solomon Islands are there back and forth. But Nepal and Haiti and Cote d'Ivoire are good examples of states which were once reasonably secure And if we had watched them more closely, we might have helped them stop sliding into failure. So the point of talking about fail states is that so that we can prevent failure and therefore prevent conflict.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Al. Al calling from Reno, Nevada.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What I wanted to say basically had to do more with how do you handle fail states. Number one, I think that if we're going to allow self-determination for countries, then we ought to view a failed state as an acceptable consequence, because some people are better at running countries than other people. So knowing that it's something that could happen, just like you know that a hurricane is something that could happen, I believe that world government organizations ought to develop a suite of tools and services where if a state is failing but they still have a legitimate central government, that a world government governing body can offer, like FEMA comes in after a hurricane, a world government body can offer a suite of tools and services that might help strengthen a central government. If it's determined that there is no legitimate central government, then maybe the world government structure could create a set of tools to isolate that country, arms embargoes, economic embargoes, carefully checking the visas and passports of being issued from that country to kind of cut down on terrorists and what have you not. But I really think that it ought to not be forced on a country to take these suite of tools and services, but they ought to exist so that if a country wants to take advantage of it, it's something that they can use.
Robert Rotberg, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's important, just as the questioner says, that it's important to have these tools, but mostly to prevent conflict, and then and to prevent state failure, and then if the state fails, some of those tools are very useful to strengthen the state back where it can perform services for its people. The goal here is to prevent governments from becoming illegitimate, and in most failed states, the governments are not legitimate any longer, so there's a vacuum, and it's up to the United Nations and other international and regional bodies to take a role. But as I said before, the most important thing is to prevent these weak states from becoming failed states
in the first place. David Bosco, is failure an option?
Unfortunately, it is.
Excuse me, we'll get your mic on in just a moment. Thank you.
Unfortunately, it is an option, and it's an option that some countries have taken, willingly or not. But just to go to kind of what I thought was a very important point about the suite of tools available, there is kind of an embryonic international system for dealing with failed states. I mean, we're talking about UN peacekeeping forces, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. All of these institutions, you know, in varying ways and with varying degrees of effectiveness, try to go in and prevent failure. And so I think it's important to strengthen those tools, because often people unfortunately think about it as military intervention or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is a short-sighted way of looking at it, because I think, as Professor Rotberg indicated, military intervention is a sign that things have really gotten to the point of no return. There are many, many tools, including just good standard diplomacy, that need to be used before we get to that stage of intervention.
Mm. Al, thanks very much for the call. Let's turn now to Alex. Alex calling from California.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to have your guest comment on how much is the role of superpowers intervening in small countries, like I'll give you a good example of Pakistan, and bringing and supporting military regimes there, and for their own interests. I ought to take my answer off the phone.
Hard to define Pakistan necessarily as a small country, but we'll take his point. Professor Rotberg.
Well, I don't think intervention, as David just said, is the first line of prevention. But a good example is what's happening in the tiny place, the Solomon Islands. The Australians were quickly called back in for the second time to deal with state collapse in that particular place, and they stand ready to do the same in Papua New Guinea, and in Cote d'Ivoire, when Cote d'Ivoire slid from strength to failure, the French were there, and then a UN force. These forces are there to hold the ring, that is, to provide the security glue without which you can't build back rule of law, economic opportunity, or provide state state functioning once again. So there is a surgical role for intervention, even if not a long-term role.
Go ahead.
Neil, if I could, I just wanted to... I think the caller pointed to something important, though, which is that major powers often have, I mean, if we look at, you know, the last century, have often intervened in countries, propped up military governments or, you know, inserted puppet leaders to pursue their short-term national interests. And that has often had a very deleterious impact on the long-term stability of that state. And so I think it is important to recognize that states, great powers, in the way they intervene, can often, you know, achieve some of their short-term goals, but have a very harmful long-term impact on a country's stability.
And Robert Rotberg, let me ask you about some of the tools that we've been talking about in terms of the, you know, IMF and the World Bank. And people say that those are, in fact, some people in the world say those are, in fact, instruments that are used by great powers that run them, in fact, are not in the interests of the countries that they're being imposed upon, that this is, you know, this is contrary to their sovereignty.
Well, of course, in some cases that's true in a general sense. But where we have a state which is sliding from weakness to failure, and its own people are therefore in danger of being harmed, it's important that the new UN responsibility to protect norm be used, and that UN Chapter 7 be wheeled in to deal to prevent the state itself from harming its own people.
Chapter 7 authorizes, at the end of the day, the use of force.
That's right. But the preventive diplomacy is the first line. There are all kinds of sanctions which can be used. If those don't work to straighten out the state, the one instrument which is too infrequently used is simply naming and shaming. That is, it's a very good idea for the leaders of world order, the UN and others, and big powers, to simply say that is unacceptable, and we're going to call it unacceptable, and perhaps lead to Chapter 7 sanctions and others. This would have been very helpful in Cote d'Ivoire. It's now should be very helpful in Zimbabwe, which is imploding by the minute, inflation over 1,000% and so on. So Zimbabwe is one of those cases where we could use naming and shaming. We could use actually calling what it is, a weak state almost collapsing.
Robert Rotberg, thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Robert Rotberg, director of the Program on Interstate Conflict and Conflict Resolution at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, author of Why States Fail, Causes and Consequences, with us today by phone from Montreal. Let me now introduce Christopher Preble, director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. The July issue of Reason magazine features an article he co-authored along with Justin Logold entitled Are Failed States a Threat to America? And he joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much.
And your conclusion, are they a threat to the United States?
Well, the answer is that sometimes they are, but oftentimes they're not. And the example that's most often cited is Afghanistan. Afghanistan was clearly a failed state. There's no question about that. But in fact, the instances in which a failed state poses a threat to the United States by actively and knowingly supporting terrorists, for example, are actually quite rare. And I'm struck by the discussions we've had even today talking about the Solomon Islands or Ivory Coast or Papua New Guinea. There no doubt are a number of horrible things happening there, but it's not true and not transparently clear to me and to my co-author, Justin Logan, that those kinds of things pose a threat to the United States.
And if they therefore don't represent a threat to the United States interest in doing something about them?
Well, first of all, I mean, U.S. foreign policy should be dedicated first and foremost to preserving our life and liberty here in the United States and our interests abroad. And that should be the primary object. And what is most troubling to us is the argument that fixing failed states should be at the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy, and that's pretty much what the Bush administration has said, as well as many others. It's gotten a certain kind of cachet after 9/11, again, because of Afghanistan, but these ideas were circulating in the 1990s as well, going back to interventions in Somalia and Haiti and later in the Balkans.
The idea of nation building, which President Bush was initially not so enthusiastic about.
Not only not so enthusiastic about it, he was explicitly quite disdainful of it, and of course, famously, Secretary Rice, who was then Condoleezza Rice's advisor, famously said that we should not have the 82nd Airborne escorting kids to kindergarten, which is a fairly fairly straightforward arguments that I think most Americans are sympathetic to, the notion that the U.S. military should be dedicated first and foremost to defending us and our security and liberty, and leaving the fixing of failed states, even to the extent that it can be done, to other organizations, humanitarian institutions, NGOs, things like that.
Mm-hmm. David Bosco, let's bring you back into the conversation in terms of clearly the Solomon Islands and represents no threat to the United States. But what about this idea of nation building? You've been to Afghanistan, you've been to Bosnia, two examples.
Yeah, well, I think nation building is a phenomenally difficult task. And in Bosnia, for example, you see that a decade on, there still are international forces there. But it's something that can work. And I think a kind of trying to turn nation building into a dirty word or a dirty phrase is not something that's helpful. And I think it's interesting that the Bush administration, I think, would have done better in Iraq and Afghanistan had they learned some of the lessons from the nation building experiences in Bosnia and Kosovo that I think Mr. Preble might have opposed. But in important ways, those are quite successful operations. And the idea, just because there are international forces still there, doesn't mean that those have failed. That part of Europe was headed, for example, toward economic collapse. You know, there were refugees spilling out all over Europe, political radicalization. That has been stemmed because of effective intervention and effective nation building. Nation building through intervention is the last recourse, but it can be an important one. And I think the Bush administration should, instead of looking back disdainfully on that, should try to learn some lessons from those missions.
Well, I mean, first of all, the explanation that the Balkans were slipping into chaos, there's no question about that, and the Europeans had a vested interest in doing something about it, just as the Aussies had a vested interest in doing something in the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, just as the French, with a long history of involvement in Ivory Coast, intervened there. So again, this is about U.S. foreign policy and where U.S. foreign policy should be focused.
But the Europeans, they may have had a vested interest in intervening in the Balkans, but they weren't. And
because we were actively discouraging them from doing so for a long time.
No.
Look, I mean, the notion that it's brought up and we raise it in our paper, the notion that more effective nation building or attention to nation building would have helped things in Iraq, I think misses an important point. And that is, you must have security first and foremost in order to accomplish nation building. It is exceptionally difficult even under the best of circumstances. And the kinds of security that you need and the size of forces that you need to stabilize a country the size of Iraq is truly massive.
We're talking with Christopher Preble of the Cato Institute and David Bosco of Foreign Policy Magazine about failed states. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller in. And this is Abdi calling from Overland Park in Kansas. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. Great show. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that I've grown up in Somalia and I experienced the Civil War firsthand. I was there in 1990 up to 1996, so I witnessed both the coming and going of the UN and the American soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And today, the Islamists took over Mogadishu 90% and defeated the alleged American allied warlords. And I was wondering, what do you think about that and how the U.S. should respond to that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Somalia, clearly a case, a failed state by, I guess, anybody's definition. And we'll have time for comments from both of you. David Bosco, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I think Somalia is interesting to compare what's happening there right now with what happened in Afghanistan when the Taliban took power. Because one of the kind of wrinkles in looking at this issue is that it's not just the state failure. It's often what follows on the state failure. The Taliban came to power because they could promise to the Afghan people that they were going to restore the country from chaos. And they were able to get a lot of support because they could say, look, you know, there are rapes and murders and, mm-hmm. and total chaos. And so similarly, I suspect this group that's taking control of Mogadishu is promising much the same. And so it's not just the failure. It's what comes after. And when people have been radicalized and beaten down by state failure, they're often willing to accept governments that are repulsive, repugnant in many ways. And could be quite contrary to U.S. national interests.
Yet, Christopher Preble, we all have unfortunate memories of intervention in Somalia.
Indeed we do. And I think it does. It raises the point that you have to focus on what exactly is the nature of the threat posed to the United States. Is it different from the threat that's posed by the neighboring states? And I don't disagree at all. The Taliban was, again, tragically, and it was seen by some as an improvement over what went before in Afghanistan, which says about how bad things were in Afghanistan. But it's not just a function of state failure. It's what are the intentions of the leaders and what are their aims.
So just leave it fester?
No, absolutely not. I think there are opportunities and there are initiatives that do not depend upon the United States first and foremost to intervene. I think the great mistake we made in Somalia as well as other places is, again, assuming that if the United States doesn't do it, no one will. And that's, again, it's simply not true. And we've cited Professor Rotberg when he was online, cited those cases himself.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there, but thank you both very much for being with us. That last voice was that of Christopher Preble of the Cato Institute, and we also with us in the studio, David Bosco, senior editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks to you both.
Thanks so much.
When we come back from a break, an update as presidential candidates prepare for a critical televised debate in Mexico, plus the strange, sad, and brief story of an 11-year-old pirate. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.